Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, December 16th. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine. Then, in response to several subscriber requests, a discussion with Daniel Eschelin from Madrid on who rules, who's who, and the changes underway in political and economic power. Our theme tonight is Happy Holidays. Holiday greetings from Solari. We've posted them up on the blog. We did a special Christmas card with artist Lesta Frank. It's called A Bountiful Christmas Tree. And you can see it on the blog and link to it from the blog up onto our website. What we've done is we've made a Christmas tree covered with fresh food, and we've been inspired to donate for every country and every state in the United States where we have a subscriber. We've donated to a food bank and, in one case, a farmer's market in your area. So if you check it out on the blog and link to it, we posted links to all 73 food banks and farmers markets, and we hope it will help encourage you to remember your food banks in your annual giving at this time. I'm going to be in Philadelphia for Christmas and New Year's. I'm headed this Saturday night for my annual trip to the Philadelphia Orchestra's Glorious Sounds of Christmas. I've been doing it every year, inspired by Georgie. And then I'm up in New York next week. I'll be seeing lots of clients and subscribers both in New York and Philadelphia over the holidays. Anyway, it's a favorite time of year for me, and I hope it is for you. It's a time when hopefully we take time to nurture our joy. In a world this stressful, it's very important to do. Money and markets. In Europe, rounds of demonstration in England, Greece, and Italy. What we're watching is a reconciliation of the general population to a fundamental global repricing in capital to labor and long-term structural unemployment. We haven't seen a lot of protests and demonstrations in the United States, but the tensions are moving through the Eurozone and are probably coming this way. A very interesting article by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard on the response of Iceland to the bank problems and the demand that Iceland really cut its social safety net to bail out corrupt banks, and a comparison of the Icelandic response to Ireland. Iceland is insisting on much more clarity and accountability and was much more supportive of the people versus the banks, and he points out that the Iceland economy is coming back very quickly, and it's a very interesting comparison, and I encourage you to read it. It's up on the blog. North America, the new tax bill has passed the Senate. It's on its way to becoming law. The new Rasmussen report out tonight shows still the Americans favor the tax agreement, but it's down to polls show 52%. Part of getting the Senate to pass required Bill Clinton doing a press conference in support of the president. It's a very interesting press conference to watch. I posted it. It's up on the blog. We have several commentaries up on the tax agreement, and it's a very interesting presentation and honestly a very savvy political standpoint presentation. One of the things that's coming out and is hinted to by Clinton is the extent to which this tax deal is part of a bigger tax deal coming, a serious redo of Social Security. One of the things I've been sitting around watching and sort of scratching my head about is the fact that we've seen real silence on IRAs or 401ks and the sort of the trial balloons being floated to change those. And now I suspect I know why, which is it's going to be part of a much bigger deal on Social Security. Interestingly enough, again, up on the blog, we have an announcement that the Department of Justice and the feds are doing, or the federal government is doing more investigations of 401ks, the implication being you can't trust small businesses. This is exactly the kind of thing that happens when they're coming into doing a big kind of change. So if anything, that delays when it might happen, but it makes it much harder to stop because it's going to be part or tacked onto a much bigger train. The food safety bill is back on track. We've also seen President Obama signing a new law, Healthy, Hungry, Free Kids Act of 2010, which for the first time gives the federal government the authority to regulate all foods at schools, including what's in vending machines. According to the new Rasmussen Report survey, 23% of adults say the federal government should set nutritional standards for public schools. 31% say they would rather see parent-teacher groups do it. 17% feel state government should do it. Very few people really supporting that. It's been a very bad month for Hillary Clinton at the State Department, which makes it tough on the administration. The WikiLeaks, the WikiLeaks leaks really hit Clinton and the State Department hard, as we discussed last week. But now we have the death of Richard Holbrooke, who was handling much of what was going on in Afghanistan and Eurasia. And he is a longtime trusted aide of Clinton. So interesting times at the U.S. State Department. Ron Paul is getting a lot of attention. And what's interesting is as those of you who've heard the last couple's precious metals reports know, I think where this has been going for a long time is sort of an end game where gold is moved to a very central part of this sort of new world global financial currency. And so we now have an interesting situation where you have leadership moving into position arguing for gold and silver as a sound currency, and interestingly enough looking like someone who's speaking for the grassroots, but I think it's very much headed into alignment with where the leadership is going. In the heartlands, more on the Gulf oil spill, we have the U.S. government moving to be a party to all lawsuits. I explained that, showed the article on it on the blog to a lawyer, and a lawyer said, they can't do that. I said, well, they think they can. You also see them moving with lawsuits of their own directly against BP. And the impression is they're looking legally to control the entire situation. The whole range of litigation is if this succeeds, is going to really be in a Department of Justice lockdown. It's interesting that this happens at the same time Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, has a new TV program on the Gulf oil spill, a very far-reaching look at allegations that the explosion causing the spill was intentional. And the circumstantial evidence continues to mount up. It's posted up on the blog. Wall Street is indicating they expect a record year. It's not the best year, but maybe second best year, but they are anticipating record bonuses, which will be very in your face given the extent to which many Americans are struggling and given the structural unemployment and how much of the problems are perceived as coming from financial fraud and from Wall Street. In Asia, China continues to struggle with inflation and particularly food inflation. With so much money looking to shift out of Asia and Europe and out of the bond market looking for some kind of growth and yield, East Asia and the subcontinent are grappling with a lot of people that's coming their way looking for an engine to keep it propped up. On the Midianite thing, that's a category I'm going to keep using for those of you who haven't heard me describe the Midianite thing. That's a description from the Old Testament in which Gideon is able to defeat or throw the Midianites out of Israel because they're so hateful and distrustful and suspicious that they kill each other. So the Midianite thing refers to factionalism in the leadership. Halliburton's trying to settle the criminal charges in Nigeria, including those pertaining to Cheney. This relates to when Cheney was chairman of our CEO of Halliburton. The amounts rumored to be offered to indicate that clearly crime still pays. Madoff's son, the suicide is posted, the story is posted on the blog, along with a list of many other recent suspicious deaths related to financial fraud, another symptom that it's more difficult and dangerous these days to be in a leadership position. Attack on Prince Charles that happened last week, I was talking with Daniel Estulin earlier this week, and one of the things he said, and it's a very good point, is nothing like that can happen unless their protection stands down. It's likely it's not just grassroots eye or somebody sending a message from someone to the royal family, another example of what is probably the Midianite thing. Financial markets, the outflows from the domestic equity markets continue. concerns continue about the bond markets, particularly the municipal bond markets, inspiring Bill Gross of PIMCO, the largest bond mutual fund manager, to start buying up some of PIMCO's mutual funds this year, or this week. The Commodity Futures Trade Commission was expected to announce position limits and position limit regulations and backed off on some. There's a video that will go up on the blog by tomorrow of an interview on Bloomberg with Bart Shilton explaining why and the importance of getting some of the regulations right. As you can hear from his description, the concern is we have in the precious metals markets, you have a number of the big banks, particularly J.P. Morgan, with major positions. They're the vast majority of the shorts in some markets. So position limits that go very much at their positions are part of the politics on this thing. A very savvy subscriber pointed out that CalPERS has announced a new allocation system for their portfolio. The net result will be that there's going to be less in fixed income and commodities and more in real estate and equity. It's a very interesting shift. I've had a day to look at it. I think there's something very important going on here. I'm going to be looking for more examples. The changes that we see in allocation systems and plans in the big institutional investors, particularly pension funds, are going to signal a lot about which way the world is planned to go and where the greatest sort of value is considered to be, and these are important and very deep changes. So anybody seeing more on changes in institutional investment and pension allocation systems, definitely post it or send it my way. I very much appreciate that. In the precious metals market, I'm going to get on my soapbox and give a little speech. I normally don't do this except on the precious metals reports, but I think it's time. In the last couple of weeks, it's really the last 2 to 4 weeks, I've had more than a few people discussing issues related to taking silver profits or trading the gold-silver ratio with their coins. And what has come up is the sort of the assumed notion that if you're selling coins and you're selling less than 10,000 or less than 10,000 at a time, that you really don't have to pay your taxes. And this really communicates a lack of understanding. I want to emphasize to you, there are no secrets. Let me say it again, there are no secrets. If you sell coins to someone, whether it's a dealer or someone else, and you have gains that are taxable on those sales, and you don't report it, and you are literally turning over to the person you sold it to the power to turn you and your name in, particularly if they're under pressure legally, in a situation where some or all of your assets can be confiscated. Now, if you're worried about confiscation of your precious metals, you should be a lot more worried about confiscation of all your assets. So the notion that you're going to save money by not paying taxes is literally taking a kind of risk. I mean, it's taking unbelievable risk because you're literally turning over the power to one person, in many cases a stranger, to literally wipe you out. And that's just not a risk you want to take. It's not worth it. It's not a good investment. It's just not on a risk-adjusted basis. It's absolutely insane. Please do not do it. And you should, if you're worried about confiscation because of changes in the law, you need to be worried about confiscation under current law. Do not give anybody the right to confiscate your assets. Our hero this week is U.S. District Judge Henry E. Hudson, who ruled that the central bank of the health care law, the requirement that most Americans carry insurance, violates the Constitution. He said, quote, it exceeds the constitutional boundaries of congressional power. Interestingly enough, I don't know if they're just, they're resonating together or the decision helped inspire a change, but the latest Rasmussen Report National Telephone Survey shows that 60% of likely U.S. voters at least somewhat favor repeal of the health care law, with 34% are opposed. So there continues to be a strong discomfort with provisions in the health care law. Runner-up for Hero of the Week is Bernie Sanders of Vermont for his 8.5 filibuster against the tax agreement, asking some very profound and very important questions about equity and fairness in America. And then a second runner-up to Michael Moore, who posted funds for Julian Assange's bail, the WikiLeaks founder, reminding us that grace and humor are more delightful than being afraid. Okay, Ask Catherine. Precious metals. We have a question. William Black recently said on the Real News Network with Paul Jay that previous to 1913, there were more freaking booms and busts with gold-backed currencies, and that precious metal-backed currencies are no silver bullet for reform of the monetary system. I agree with Black. Black's a very sound commentator and, always makes tremendous sense. Silver, precious metals have a role to play in a sound currency. But the reality is that any monetary system is based in laws and rules, and if our society is going to behave in lawless ways, then using precious metals for the currency is not going to result in a sound currency. We're still going to have a lawless system. So, a monetary system is a human system, and it's a system based in laws. So it comes back again to the enforcement question, which is, if we create a system based in law, how do we enforce it and make sure it applies to everybody? And the enforcement and the application of the law is optimal. Another question: how do I invest in gold through an IRA? There's a wonderful section on the Solari Silver and Gold website that explains how to invest in gold or silver through an IRA. So if you go to the Solari website or the blog, just click on Solari Silver and Gold, and you'll see a little picture of a piggy bank, and it says investing in IRAs, and just click on that, and you'll find all the information you could ever want. Okay, Who Rules with Daniel Estulin? We've had numerous subscribers request that we do an interview with Daniel, and we contacted his publisher, Chris Milligan, at Trine Day, and he was nice enough to arrange for Daniel to be on the Solari Report. Daniel lives in Madrid. It's now 3:20 a.m. in Madrid. So Daniel said, please let me pre-record. So we did earlier this week. And so now let me proceed with the recording of Daniel Estulin from Madrid. Who rules? It's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report Daniel Estulin. Daniel is the author of Bilderberger, a great book on the Bilderbergers and the Shadow Masters, and has, as I described in the blog post, has done a tremendous amount to try and get to the bottom of who's really in control and why are they doing what they're doing. He's based in Madrid, and so we're speaking to him from Spain, and we're also going to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about what's going on there. Daniel, welcome to the Solari Report.
It's my pleasure, Tasha. It's great to be on your show.
And thank you so much for, I know how busy your schedule is. I should mention, you told me yesterday that your books have sold 5 million copies now worldwide.
Modestly speaking, yes, 81 countries, 51 languages, and I've had quite a few important individuals such as Fidel Castro, who discovered my book at the ripe old age of 84. Now I understand, like you said, I never understood why the Rockefellers were actually, financing Soviet revolution. Now I understand, thanks to your book.
Now tell me, how many languages do you speak? You speak English, you speak Spanish?
Russian, that's my mother tongue, obviously. And Italian. I used to live in Italy for quite a few years. I spent over 3 years researching in the National Library of Florence, the roots of the Bilderbergers. And so actually, a long time ago, about 10 years ago, I spoke the Middle Age Italian, arcane Italian from the 14th century. Not probably the best thing you want to speak when you want to pick up a girl in a bar, but still, it came in quite useful because learned it in the 3 years of researching it. And I can read fluently Bulgarian and Serbo-Croatian, which of course are Cyrillic languages.
So for tracking global networks, you really have a remarkable history and background.
But tell us, how did you get so interested in the Bilderbergers? And how did this begin as really an extraordinary passion, and till now it looks like a lifelong interest?
Well, I got involved in this over steak and potato lunch in Toronto's appropriately Spanish restaurant called Segovia, just off of Yonge Street, the 10th longer street. It was back in 1992, and a friend of my grandfather was a colonel of the KGB counterintelligence. Well, this man, the weirdest man I've ever met in my life. I met quite a few weird people, but I've never met, before or after anyone as weird as that man. He was a friend of my grandfather's. As it turned out, he was a double agent working for the KGB and MI6 or MI5, I'm not quite sure. And over steak lunch, she basically told me, matter of fact, in 1992, that in 1995, Canada was going to be broken up into French and English-speaking parts. And, that English-speaking Canada is going to join the United States, integrate in North America. And I said to him, tongue-in-cheek, I said, oh, yeah, really? Why is that? And he said, well, because, big, powerful men in Washington need to balance their books. And he called a waiter, and he ordered another steak dinner. And that's how I got into it. It wasn't, in the middle of the night, just reading all an angel came to me and told me, actually I should get into this quest. It was really, one of the funniest things is, and then 1995 came around, and of course after this lunch, I completely forgot about this man. Until 1995 came around, and suddenly, the French separatists were making all the right noises, and all the things that this man was telling me is that it was Vladimir. Back in 1992, we're beginning to actually come through one step at a time, and there were a lot of, just think of it as a chessboard and a chess game, and a lot of pieces were being moved, and all the pieces were being moved exactly in the way this man had predicted 3 years ago.
Right, and it seems very organic, but it's so orchestrated. That's what I always find fascinating.
It is orchestrated, and basically when it came to that point, I said to myself, well, if the president and prime ministers, really don't control the situation, then, who the hell runs the world? And that's basically how I got into it, really, in 1995.
Uh-huh.
I was initially introduced into this world of smoke and mirrors, to this parallel world of intelligence operations back in 1992.
And so tell us about how you got from there to writing from publishing the Bilderberger book.
I had been attending Bilderberg conferences, not as an attendee, obviously, but as a journalist covering them, for about on and off 12 years. And in 2004, I was in Madrid, again, on lunch with a friend of mine who was working at a media called Intereconomia. The owner of this media called Glomerate, he had discovered this secret society, what he thought was, they called them the Bilderbergers, because he had this strange fixation with the Masons. And, somehow clicking on a link, it led him to the Bilderbergers. And, next thing he was calling this, the top secret meeting of all the top employees of this media group, asking them if anyone knew anything about the Bilderbergers. And my friend, who was at the meeting, because he was the chief editor of the magazine called Epoca, he said, I just happen to know a guy who's been following these people for, about 12 years. And I was sitting on the other side of the wall. So, I don't know, call it serendipity, call it luck, or whatever you want to call it. Well, basically, about 3 weeks or a month later, my first article on the Bilderbergers came out in the mainstream Spanish press. That was back in 2004. And needless to say, you can think of it as an atomic bomb type of an explosion, because no one has ever heard of these people in Spain except for the people who actually attended the conferences. And I immediately was offered a deal by Planeta, which is Spain's biggest media group and biggest publishing company, and the fourth biggest publishing company in the world. And my book came out in 2005 and immediately sold about 20,000 copies in a matter of days.
It really your book really rocketed when it first came out, I remember.
It came out in Spain in September 2005, and it went right to number one. And I stayed for number one for about 40 straight weeks. And then, needless to say, all the other countries, got on board as well. Except in most other, especially in the United States, my book is published by Friday, which is a very small publishing company based out of Oregon. You can say that, in countries such as the United States, where the media control is so strong, there's very little chance that a mainstream publication touch anything like Bilderberg unless they want to buy it and then not to publish it, which is exactly what happened in Denmark. I'd say the biggest advance in the history of Denmark by this company called JP Politik. And these are the same people who came out with the Mahoma, Mohammed cartoons, if you remember, back in 2005. And the team with the biggest advance in the history of Denmark, even bigger than Harry Potter and then Dan Brown, only not to publish my book. And they basically, you know, kept it hostage for about 2 years and then let it go. But basically, that's how media cartels work.
Now, tell us who the Bilderbergers are. Who are the Bilderbergers and how important are they?
You know, I think it's much easier to tell you what or who they're not.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a lot of, you know, crazy conspiracy theories out there, but these conspiracy freaks who seem to believe that it's some kind of a one-eyed monster. It, you know, Bilderberg is not a Cartesian fantasy world in which the isolated intentions of some individuals instead of the dynamics of social processes shape the course of history as the movement of evolving ideas and themes over successive generations. It's not a one-world government. It's not a Jewish Masonic conspiracy. No, it's not an all-seeing eye. No group of people, I don't care how powerful they are, sit around a long table in a dark room holding hands, staring at a crystal ball, planning the world's domination. The idea behind each and every Bilderberg meeting is to create what they themselves call the aristocracy of purpose between Europe and North American elites on the best ways to manage the planet. In other words, the creation of a global network of giant cartels more powerful than any nation on Earth destined to control in the necessities of life, basically, for the rest of humanity. It initially was the old NATO alliance, Western Europe, the United States, and Canada. The idea, again, it's not one world government. It's rather one world company limited, the idea of corporations, which are far more powerful than any government on the planet. And we're seeing it in Europe right now, in stark terms, in Ireland and Greece. And soon to come to Spain, we have no-name politicians unelected by anyone in the world who basically, you know, telling independent nations such as Ireland or Greece who and what they should cut and where, what they should do with their financial systems. And again, if people don't understand the idea of what that means, it's very difficult for them to understand what Bilderberg is because, again, it's not a one-world government. As a lot of people point out to George H.W. Bush's speech back in the 1990s, it's, again, the concept is, One World Company Limited. It's a different kind of conspiracy. It's very significant because it's a medium of bringing together financial institutions, which are the world's most powerful, most predatory financial interests. And at this time, it is that combination which is the enemy of humanity.
Now, explain what's happened in Spain over the last year as a example of the kind of centralization we're seeing economically and the dictation to government of what they will and will not do.
Well, basically, Spain is one of many rupture points in Europe. You have Europe is basically dead. Most of Europe is a walking cadaver. You have Spain has been dead for a very, very long time. Ireland has been dead for a long time as well. Greece has been dead since about 2006. Hungary in the summer, this past summer, you know, declared bankruptcy. And Baltic states are out of it as well. England is in deep recession. So, you know, Spain is just another example of this globalization under Spain, which is basically just another word for an empire, right? And this is what you have in Spain. You have about 40% unemployment rate. You have every industry has been destroyed, which is what is happening in the United States. And, it's, you know, it's a no future society, but again,
it's been
they deindustrialized the whole country. They've done the same thing in the United States, they've done the same thing in Britain, and they're trying to do the same all over the world because again, what they're trying to do is they're trying to destroy, the economy. They're doing it on purpose because, you know, as you and I talked yesterday, it's the idea of the destruction of the world economy has very much to do with the population gains because progress and development is directly proportional to population. In fact, about a month or 2 months ago, one of these recent polls came out of Spain, and because of such tremendous destruction in Spain financial level, you know, and we have again 40% of unemployment and 30% of the people unemployed and in families on welfare, that the population growth has been reduced by 6.7%. Which is again, you know, it's part and parcel of what these people have been planning for a very, very long time. And again, it's just one of many countries, and it doesn't matter if it's left or right, because in Spain you have supposedly socialist government. Of course, they're not socialist at all. It's an extreme right-wing government, although they go as socialist. Just the other day, they let tanks out on the street because apparently, you know, to keep order, because Spain is becoming ungovernable, which is, you know, you could say the same for Greece, you could say the same for Ireland, you could say the same thing for Lithuania and Hungary, and just, you know, it's across the board. And unfortunately, these people don't understand, and they won't understand, and they'll do their utmost. When I say these people, I'm talking about the European Commission, the European Parliament, the members of this Parliament, and they'll, you know, they will do whatever it takes to make sure that Euro and Europe stay together, which is one of the things they discussed at the staff Bilderberg conference in Sitges in Barcelona.
Now, at the 2010 meeting, what was the agenda? You covered the 2010 meeting.
Well, I basically covered all of the meetings.
Uh-huh.
You know, the conclusion of 2010 meeting is that we are nowhere near the bottom of this economic downturn. I'm reading literally from the Bilderberg report. There'll be significantly more pain. This is what the Bilderbergers themselves are saying to the health in the financial sector. And as one Bilderberger said, quote unquote, Europe is up to its eyeballs in problem because Western European banks have dangerously high credit exposure to the neighboring emerging market economies. And, needless to say, deflation is a big concern. You know, they were talking about the Baltic Dry Index, which is the cost of shipping raw materials around the world. That has lost 84% of its value in less than a year. You tell me how they're going to, you know, run their business with that. And one of the key messages to come out of Bilderberg this year is that Greece's troubles have not only exposed the structural flaws of the European Monetary Union, but have also exposed the structural problems in the global economy. And, you know, again, they were talking about also the sovereign debt crisis, which is unfolding, and also a currency crisis, which is also, upon us, which is what they were saying. As another Bilderberger said, when Europe chose to go all in by pledging backstops to the downward spiraling weak countries within the Eurozone, they made the conscious decision to devalue the euro and to inflate away the debt. These are the kinds of very frank discussions which take place within Bilderbergers. And needless to say, you know, this type of information could never, ever come out, because just imagine what kind of problems it would cause, because most people will actually understand what, you know, the meaning of that. And again, a more important point is, as far as Europe is, one of the questions at the Bilderberg conference was, will the Eurozone survive? And one of the strategies that these people were dealing with, and I was the first person to actually say it, and now everybody's talking about this, and I got it from my sources at Bilderberg, is Bilderbergers are talking about forcing weaker, financially challenged members, such as Spain, such as Portugal, such as Ireland, Italy, to forfeit their European membership, because as a German Bilderberger pointed out, if it becomes obvious that a Greek euro is not monetarily equal to a German euro, then the monetary union cannot survive. In other words, what is being hotly debated in this is a multi-tier membership of the European Union and a mechanism for entering and leaving the single currency. And again, as I said before, stronger nations such as Germany and France, they will do anything in their power to make sure that Europe stays together, because they've been working towards this end since the first Bilderberger meeting in 1954. They must have their European Union as a penultimate step towards creating, you know, the global pan-world economic union, which again has nothing to do with nation-state republics. It has everything to do with destroying nation-states, destroying countries. You see, in Spain, because before we had a country, a constitution, a currency, a flag, and now we don't have any of that. See, in the United States, you apparently have something that resembles that, but not really. But in Spain, we don't have any of that. We don't have a currency of our own. We don't have a flag of our own. We haven't had a constitution of our own in times of crisis. For example, European constitution takes precedence over a national constitution, and you obviously know how easily crisis can be orchestrated from behind the scenes. And also, you know, a nation state controls its own monetary policy. That's one of the reasons, for example, the American government hates Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. It's not that he's a dictator, because Americans have supported the world's worst dictators throughout history. It's because, you know, he has its own, they control their own currency, they control their natural resources, and that's something, unfortunately, we don't no longer have in Spain. In Spain, we had a long time ago, before the euro, we had a country, we had a currency, a flag, a constitution, our own monetary policy, fiscal policy, and now Spain, Greece, France, Ireland lost, you know, the ability to basically decide for themselves how best to feed their own citizens. You know, we don't have our own flag. We don't have our own constitution. European constitution takes precedence in times of crisis over national constitutions. And you know how easily a crisis can be orchestrated from behind the scenes. And our currency is not ours. It's the euro. It's this international, you know, unit which, you know, does not belong to Spain. And also Spain no longer has the right to feed its own citizens. These directives and instructions come directly from Brussels. And again, by people and politicians and bureaucrats unelected by anyone in the entire world, mm-hmm. and who obviously have nothing to do with interests for the Spaniards or the French or the Irish or the German, who obviously work for the interests of this international conglomerate, and call it whatever you want, the Bilderberg Group, the One World Company Limited, but it's transnational corporations whose idea has nothing to do with the progress, growth, and humanity.
Essentially, what we're watching is a financial system, in other words, debt, by getting countries deeply in debt and compromising their, what I would call their information sovereignty and financial sovereignty, you can control on a non-accountable basis from behind the scenes. Because I look at the Spanish legislature, the Irish legislature, and I say, why would they, and the governments, why would they agree to all of this? Because they're over a financial barrel, and they're the target of covert operations. So you're really, you're not watching a financial system as much as a financial control system. And you're right.
You know, the question of of control and the philosophy behind it, it has nothing to do with money at all. It has to do with development of mankind, of humanity. It has to do with development of the power of the individual and the power of the nation, which depends upon scientific developments, which are used to increase the power of man over nature. And, of course, on the other hand, if you're dealing with the empire, and this is what this is an empire, you know, this empire of money, which depends upon suppression of scientific development, a suppression of knowledge, but keeping us backwards and dumb. And, of course, the people have to participate in self-government. They must participate in the ideas by which society is self-governed. That, again, goes back to the idea of nation-state republics. And, of course, this would mean the end of oligarchism. Nations which foster the creative mental development of their population will produce people who will not tolerate oligarchic forces and forms of government indefinitely. So basically what you have to do is you have to destroy the population by making them stupid, by destroying them financially, economically, intellectually, and destroy what to me is the most important element of education, which is of higher culture, that's classical culture. Because again, you're talking about empire, you're talking about globalization, you're talking about tyranny. No nation is allowed to grow its own food, as I said before, or, you know, exert sovereignty over their technologies and natural resources. And this isn't a new idea. Those of us who understand history, have been studying where these people come from, understand that, you know, since about 1463, the reign of Louis XI in France, that was the first nation-state republic, the forces behind what's today called Bilderberg, because it's a very old society, again, it's, and you can take them back to about 800 years ago, and back then they were called the Venetian Black Nobility. So these same forces, with a Venetian model based in London today, have been working towards the destruction of the most important historical element, which has been created over the past 600 years, and that has been the idea of nation-state republic, which has given us constitution in the United States, natural law, it has given us social welfare, it has also given us, you know, the idea of what immortality stands for, the idea of making sure that future generations live in a better world, and to make sure that we as people, you know, continue being the species of humanity, and to actually be people, we have to make sure that we grow and prosper and conquer outer space, because without progress and development, again, we'll simply disappear at a certain point in time.
Daniel, do you think the push for a lower consciousness in general is a push to depopulation, or is it something else?
No, of course, absolutely. You know, you want to make people stupid. Now, how do you make people stupid? Don't give them intelligent jobs. You just eliminate technological progress. You eliminate scientific thinking. You eliminate classical culture, because classical culture breeds high quality of intellect. Instead of that, you give them, you know, rap, ska, heavy metal. You give them Lady Gaga. You know, you give them all that stupidity, which breeds stupidity. And, of course, all you need to do is look at the population itself. And, of course, that all comes... other elements come into the equation, which is why, again, you know, Bilderberg is just an element. It's not the element. It's you know, again, a lot of people mistakenly believe that it's the top of the pyramid. It's not the top of anything.
Right.
If anything, it's, you know, there's a lot of organizations such as, for example, Mold Pelerin Society, which is, you know, I'd say they're controllers of Bilderberg, and, you know, they're far more powerful.
Right.
And even fewer people know about them.
But I used to say, if you know their name, they're not powerful.
You have think tanks and foundations, and you have all these organizations, you know, interlocked amongst themselves and working together. And, you know, you have Newspeak, and you have, you know, the degeneration of cultures, and, of course, that plays into the hands of these people, because they need to destroy, you know, any vestige of humanity, and to do that, you actually destroy the human right, because it's That's our greatest natural resource. It's not oil. It's not natural gas. It's not gold. It's the ability of 6.7 billion people, which is what we are, to discover universal principles of which, of course, improve the lives of every person on the planet for a square kilometer of space against nature. And that's called progress, and that's called development, and that's why they're trying to destroy it.
Now, one of the things I really enjoy about your work is you understand the importance of narcotics trafficking and drugs to what is happening. And maybe if you could just touch on that, because I know it's part of your new book, Shadow Master.
Well, a lot of the initial material research actually comes from a lot of the things that you've been doing, because it got me to thinking, you know, how can I put them? I mean, I've known about the importance of drugs. I just didn't realize that other people actually talked about this. Yes, I spent 3.5 years in Africa back in the 1990s. And I had my camera in my left hand and my Mac 10 in my right. And I'd go to these little villages and I'd see how mafias would actually, dig for blood diamonds, and how these blood diamonds would, you know, turn into drugs, and how these drugs would feed the world economy or feed the local economy. And then I came across some of the things that you've been doing on that, and I thought to myself, well, I'm not the only person who actually understands this. You know,
uh-huh.
So in my book, Shadow Masters, which is just another step down, because the deliverables are the controllers or the, you know, the thinkers, I said to myself, well, someone needs to do it. And the Shadow Masters actually deals with the doers. So one of the first questions I ask in Shadow Masters is, what do international terrorism, the world's financial markets, you know, empire building and capitalism, I think, you know, have in common? And of course, that the utter dependency on the drug profits. We're talking about, by some estimates, $800-900 billion a year, a business. And of course, that's liquid money. It's not, it's criminal money. It's drug money. It's liquid money. It's like water. It's very thin. It goes very quickly.
It's high margin, and it's pre-tax and after-tax.
And one thing I realized is, you know, you need a lot of experience and expertise, because a lot of it I saw firsthand in Africa. To be able to move such funds stealthily, just, you know, as the same, you know, goes for blood diamonds. You need to have a lot of experience, a lot of expertise to actually be able to do this without anyone noticing. And of course, ignorance. Especially when you're laundering these kinds of transactions, $700-900 billion, it's simply not a tenable position. You know, and, I got this from you, when you're talking about, you know, explaining how the actual drug economy works. You're talking about price to earnings ratios, the pop, you know, margin, which is 15 to 1 or 30 to 1 if you're talking about, any corporations. And of course, if you take it as a strictly mathematical relationship, by adding just $1 to the company's end year results, it would create $30 or 30 euros in stock value. So you could never actually eliminate the drugs, because if you did that, the entire world economy would collapse onto itself. And, you know, we're seeing it in Afghanistan right now.
Yeah.
And again, it's a country I know fairly well. You know, this embedded reporting thingy, whatever you want to call it, I've never done that, but I've certainly been to a lot of these places. And basically, American soldiers are being sent right now to Afghanistan to be shot by an enemy that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, is defending. And, you know, what they're doing is, by refusing to go after the opium trade, which is, of course, the logistical and financial backbone of the Taliban insurgency, the Obama policy is giving these narco-insurgents, of course, a free hand to kill American soldiers. You know, back in 1996, when the Taliban took over Afghanistan, the first thing they did, they eliminated all the anapola crop, all the poppies. And that was their form of an economic atomic bomb. They didn't have an atomic bomb per se, but they certainly could eliminate the drugs. And about 8 months later, as you remember, all the Asian tigers, you know, began falling over like dominoes, and in the United States, Wall Street was left without any funds. You know, and today, if you look at Afghanistan, 97.5% of the country is actually controlled by the NATO alliance. And this year, you have the biggest poppy crop in the history of the world. And again, you know, there's a great expression in Russian. You know, those who don't understand the relationship between these two events, you know, are not on friendly terms with the brain.
One of the things I find amazing is I've watched as the American media and the European media has tried to explain why we're in Afghanistan, without, you know, being able to explain that we're there to cultivate the drug business. And,
well,
and
you know, there's also another line of reasoning that, you know, we're in Afghanistan to build democracy, and we're also there to make sure that the Afghan carpets, you know, make it to European markets.
Well, but the explanations become more and more strange and more bizarre. I think it's becoming so much more evident to most most observers that that the institutional commitment by the Western nations and leadership to building the drug business is pretty serious.
You know, you can call it open conspiracy or open secret. You know, back in March 2009, Richard Holbrooke, you know, he's very dead right now, but I hope he suffered tremendously the last few minutes of his life. Of course, President Obama's special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, seven times former, you know, Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and of course a former business partner of drug legalizer George Soros. He announced that the Obama administration was abandoning all efforts at opium eradication in Afghanistan, claiming that the program was, you know, quote-unquote, inefficient and costly, and listen to this, driving Afghan farmers into the arms of the Taliban, which of course, you know, again, in order to do this, you have to step into the sterile, you know, universe of
those dead Taliban. They probably want to grow carrots.
Well, you know, you're talking about $100 billion, which is what the Taliban make from selling these drugs. And of course, this is the money they use not to buy Afghan carpets, you know, according to popular lore, but to buy guns that kill American soldiers.
Right.
And that's what the American soldiers are there for. That's what the British soldiers are there for. And I have quite a few leaders in Spain who are army, and they basically told me the same thing. You see, all that stuff about us building roads and building democracy. Yeah, we're building roads to make sure that the drugs make it, you know, quicker to the airports. And that's what the soldiers, the Spanish soldiers, were telling me, you know, back about 6 months ago.
Right. So I've heard those stories from soldiers for many decades now. It's just getting more obvious. Now, when's the Bilderberger 2011 meeting? When's that coming up?
May, June 2011, we won't know when until about January, February. It's, they have their steering committee meeting sometime in late January, about the 20th, where they decide on a pre-list of candidates. What they do is each country, call it union representative, Bilderberger union representative, they have in each country, presents the steering committee with a list of about 10, 15 names, and then the actual pre-selection process takes about 2 or 3 months, and the final list of attendees is not sent out until end of April, and the attendees themselves won't know where the Bilderbergers are meeting in 2011 until about 2 weeks before. They know the dates, but they don't know the place, and that a lot has to do with my efforts over the years, because we've infiltrated them to such a point that they simply want to keep this thing, you know, as secret as possible for as long as possible. Unfortunately, again, you know, people want to keep it secret.
You.
Well, exactly. The only way to keep it secret is to meet underground and bring their own frying pans and, you know, carrots and cook their own lunches and dinners. Because, you know, my prediction rate in this thing is almost 100%. And, you know, it's everything from gold and silver prices to exact date of war in Afghanistan or in Iraq, sorry, to the financial meltdown in the United States and Spain, to the housing crash in Spain and the United States. All of these things were discussed at Bilderberg conferences. You know, when I was in the United States last time in 2007, and you can see it, you know, go to YouTube and you can see my conferences. I said to people that, for example, silver is going to go to about $30-$35 an ounce in about 3 years' time. That was, I think it was 7.5 at the time. Well, you know, looking at your site, Solari.com, yesterday it was 29.5. You know, I thought 3 years later, and that's about a 400% or 350% jump. Now, that's
right.
A pretty good guess, if I'm guessing. Or if I'm not guessing, it's obviously knowing something that other people don't know.
Right, and if you look at how much paper they've printed, if, you know, when the day comes when we reconcile the paper to real things, you know, all tangibles could be much higher. So, now we're watching, I mean, what we've been talking about, Daniel, is we've been talking about a force that's centralizing in a way that really implodes the economy. And if you're outside, you know, if you and I are not Bilderbergers and you're trying to build a healthy economy, the challenge is, you know, how do you build it and protect it from them? And I think, to me, part of it is getting people to separate and realize there's no point in trying to go through their institutions because they have a different agenda than our best interest. And I think what can most help people see the need to separate and, you know, make other plans is to see where these folks are going. And I would love you to just, before we finish, touch a little bit about on the competition between people such as yourself who are trying to warn where they're going and the major media. How does the major media get everybody to believe that it's okay to keep doing business with these folks?
Because, you know, what they've been able to do is convince people over the past 50 years that what you actually see on television or what you read on the front page of the New York Times or Washington Post has to be the truth because they're the mainstream press, and why would they lie? And anything else and everything that comes along, be it Solari.com, be it, you know, an interview with Daniel Lester, or it doesn't matter who or what. Until we appear on, you know, front page of the New York Times or get interviewed by CNN and show respect, whatever we have to say obviously is nonsense, because if what we're talking about, you know, the drug trade, the, you know, the manipulation of the stock markets, you know, secret societies and private organizations and creation of this one world company limited, if this is the case, then they say to you, well, why is it on the front page of the newspaper until you explain to them the media forms part of the world elite, you know, and they could never appear anywhere because all the media attends Bilderberg. But again, I'm talking about top of top officials from the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, all these organizations, you know, they're there to make sure that the truth never gets out. And, you know, they have many ways of of making sure they discredit you. I mean, you have in some quarters, you know, they try to push the conspiracy of extraterrestrials and, you know, and the space aliens. And if you start talking about this, well, then you are completely discredited. You know, there's other media such as, for example, American Free Press, which is, you know, an extreme right-wing organization and in part supported and financed by the CIA. But they are, for example, one of the few organizations who over the past 40 years have diligently assisted and attended Bilderberg conferences and reported on what these people were talking about, you know, through a journalist by the name of Jim Tucker. Of course, if you wanted to get an information out, you know, some valid information on Bilderberg through American Free Press, you know, forever, you'll be there with, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and, you know, white supremacists and the crazies and the nuts. And so you'll be discredited by the mainstream press, which is one of the things I've always been able to do because I'm very media savvy, is to make sure that I, you know, stay out of these, you know, deep, muddy, muddled waters. And they've never, ever been able to discredit me, although they certainly have tried. But again, it's getting more and more difficult for them to try to discredit me. I think they're just going to leave me alone or kill me, one of the two.
Because, no, they're not going to.
I spoke with the European.
We're putting a blessing over your head right now.
I spoke at the European Parliament, which, again, you know, crazy conspiracy nuts don't speak at the European Parliament.
Uh-huh.
Bilderberg, back in June, you know, Fidel Castro invited me to Cuba. He had read my book and loved it. You know, I just came back from Venezuela where I gave conference to Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is, again, something that conspiracy crazies don't usually, you know, get to do. You know, I'm going to Czech Republic to meet privately with the President of Czech Republic, Václav Klaus, who is an anti-European Union skeptic. And, you know, so I certainly have positioned myself very well on the world stage, sure that the information that comes out is credible and logical. And, again, that comes from the years I spent researching the roots of Bilderberg because I just couldn't understand how such a young organization, because, you know, they're 55 years young, which is nothing in human history terms. Where did they get their power? Where did they get their wealth? And how do they, you know, generate all this, you know, all this decision-making? And when I realized that what's today, again, called Bilderberg, is the creation of synergy movement of vampires between the First and the Second World War, and they, in turn, were created by the Martinist esoteric occult Masonic organization. And Martinist, right around the time of the American Revolution in 1776, and the kind of counterattack against the successes of and achievements of the American Revolution. And the Martinists themselves, they came out of what used to be known as the Venetian Black Nobility, going back to the Fourth Crusade. So I have, you know, some very strong historical legs to stand on, which is why these people don't try to, you know, don't try to pull a fast one over me. I mean, you get, unfortunately, too many crazy, crazy people out there who talk about, you know, an evil eye, you know, Jews control the world. I always felt they would love to control the world. Unfortunately, just, you know,
the big planet is hard to control.
And if you start multiplying the wealth, you realize that the real wealth is not measured in millions or billions, but in hundreds of quadrillions or quadrazillions. I don't even know what they're called. I don't quite have that much money yet. You know, but that's the real wealth. That's one of the incongruencies about what people don't seem to understand, that they're trying to destroy the world economy on purpose, not because Rockefeller, if he does that, you won't be able to make money from selling your socks. but because they already have all the world's money. They just want to make sure that the natural resources, such as water, for example, is preserved for them at our expense.
We could talk all day, Daniel, but this O'Leary Report is only an hour, so I want to thank you so much for joining us, and if you could just let us know again your website and any other books in the work.
It's DanielEsturin.com, E-S-T-U-R-I-N, and my two books are The True Story of the Bilderberg Group and Shadow Masters, both published by Prime Day Press out of Oregon by a very brave man by the name of Chris Milligan. And I do have another book in the works.
So we'll stay tuned through your website. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us on the O'Leary Report. Have a wonderful evening in Madrid.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay, that's it for this evening, I hope. I hope that's satisfied. Keep the suggestions coming. Coming up January 6th, the year-end wrap-up, The Road Turns East. The year-end wrap-up is a very important O'Leary Report for me. If there are things you want me to address or questions you have, please post them at the card or send them to communicate@soleri.com. I'd love to make sure that wrap-up is really useful for you. Then January 13th, Precious Metals Market Report. We talked a lot, Franklin and I, about the trading patterns in the first quarter, and I want to keep discussing that. I think if you haven't heard it and you have assets in precious metals, that's one you're going to want to listen to on January 13th, but I recommend the one that we did last week. If you have questions or need help and want to diversify your assets into precious metals, please do give David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, and I a call at O'Leary Silver and Gold. We're going to be working through the holiday season, and we welcome your calls. We'd love to support and help you in the precious metals market. Finally, again, I want to say that the O'Leary team and I send our gratitude and our blessings to you at this time. We hope you have a wonderful holiday season and a wonderful new year. And I want to remind you that while you're working on your New Year's resolution, that I want you to remember, please don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck and happy holidays.